Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States has surpassed 7.8 million cases of COVID-19. According to the COVID Tracking Project, the U.S. is averaging nearly 48,000 new cases a day, the highest number since mid-August. More than 215,000 people have died. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation projects that more than 135,000 people in the U.S. could die within the next 3 months. Public health experts have been warning that fall and winter could lead to a spike in cases. And based on the data that we're seeing, the fall surge has arrived. 8 months into the pandemic, we are seeing a new surge in the Northeast and the Midwest. According to John Hopkins, 40 states have reported more new COVID cases this week compared to the previous week. Joining us to talk about where we are and what we might expect in the coming months is Dr. Eric Fagelding, an epidemiologist and senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. In January, he was recognized in the media as one of the first people to alert the public on the pandemic risk of COVID. He was a researcher at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health for 16 years. Hi, Eric. Thanks so much for joining us again. Hi, do we have Eric? All right. Well, we will.
Hi, can you hear me?
Oh,
sorry.
Hi, I'm Eric. Here. Hi, thank you for joining us again.
Sure.
Well, Eric, I wanted to first ask you about Donald Trump. Your thoughts on his response to his own COVID diagnosis. And now he's going back on the campaign trail. He had a huge campaign rally in Johnstown, Pennsylvania last night. And once again, very few people were wearing masks.
Yeah, this is very concerning. Trump is very flagrant and flippant with a lot of these public health rules, because the CDC, although it says on average mild cases are contagious for 10 days after you develop symptoms, which at the beginning of the week, he just barely had 10 days. But if you have severe COVID, which he seemed to had being hospitalized and on severe medications like dexamethasone, then you're infectious for 10 to 20 days. And we're definitely not beyond 20 days since he first got sick. So all these evidence clearly show that if you follow public health guidelines, you're not supposed to be out and about if you had been that sick with COVID recently. Yet here he is, and then going to these rallies where a lot of people don't mask and don't distance. So it's right. Very worrisome.
And then we know that dozens of White House officials in Trump's circle have tested positive. Mm-hmm. Last week, Dr. Fauci came out and said that that White House Rose Garden Supreme Court event was, in fact, a super spreader event.
Yeah. And I think everyone is pointing to that event. Although I want to point out that although it seemed like it was outdoors, there was also another indoor event that was less photographed. So it was, they were not wearing masks in those indoor events either. And that is the concern, because they use a very, very thin fence. And the fence they use is this rapid antigen test, which although it's really great for capturing the vast majority of cases, it does not capture all cases. And what the Trump White House has been using is that if you pass this imperfect test, leap over this medium high fence, then you can go without mask on the inside. And we know there's asymptomatic transmission, and we know you can transmit before you test positive as the virus builds up. And so this is how exactly the virus leaked into this gaping hole in the White House security for this. And, you know, this, we have 38 cases of White House orbit people infected within just the last 2 weeks alone as a result.
And even at the outdoor event, we saw people without masks hugging, giving people mm-hmm. kisses on cheeks. I mean, those of us who are being responsible are not doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you're still supposed to, you have to have use like a Swiss cheese multi-layer defense system. You know, you can't just rely on your moat. You have to, if you're building a castle, you have to rely on your many, many layers of defense. And the testing is just one. Distancing, masks, ventilation, all of these are critically important, that by the time you go through all of them, the chance of you catching it is therefore low. But relying on any one alone is just way too risky and irresponsible. And hence, here we are.
And here we are. And Trump says he is going to be on the campaign trail every single day until Election Day. According to the New York Times, 24 COVID cases have been linked by officials in Minnesota to people who've attended these Trump campaign events in the past month.
That's right. So it was 24 cases just yesterday. And most of them, I would say most of them were linked to the Trump events. I think it was 16 of the 24. But that's still just the ones we're able to recognize. And I want to point out that contact tracing has been very difficult. And the contact tracing for the White House event actually was blocked. CDC offered their services to contact trace, but the White House blocked it. So altogether, tracing and quarantine, these are also part of the traditional toolbox for stopping an epidemic, but the White House is limiting them. So it's very worrisome, and tracing these 1,000-person rallies are almost down near impossible. So they are just really irresponsible and risky.
Eric, can you talk about the importance of contact tracing? Because on yesterday's show, we talked about a new documentary called Totally Under Control, which exposes the Trump administration's failed COVID response. And the film looked at the United States and South Korea, and both countries found out about COVID around the same time in January. And what's amazing, I'm kind of obsessed with reading about South Korea, because this is a country of 51 million people. Their death rate is only 434, which is absolutely amazing. 434 deaths in a country of 51 million people.
Exactly.
And their contact tracing is just incredible.
Yeah, contact tracing is a very fine art, and it is something that you can't just do flippantly or haphazardly, because time is of the essence. The purpose of contact tracing is to find someone who was exposed to someone who tested positive, like the close associates, as soon as possible. Because there's a time window in which that other person got exposed, maybe infected, and within like around 3 or 4 days, they can start being infectious again. On day 5, they start testing positive and showing symptoms, assuming they do. And if you don't catch them quickly enough and isolate them, then they're going to keep passing it to the next person, and the transmission chain will keep going exponentially unless you stop and find these other close associates as soon as possible. But the problem with both our testing, which is very, very slow, and again, not perfect, because sometimes you have to test 5 days in a row before you find a positive, as we know from Kayleigh McEnany, but also the aggressiveness of contact tracers. We don't have the manpower. And in South Korea, they have really detailed digital location services, mobile apps that all can trace everyone who was in the vicinity of the nightclub in which there was an outbreak. And they quickly tested 50,000 people within a few days of everyone who was near that nightclub. And that's how they got it under control.
Incredible. And,
but we don't have anything close to that.
So let's talk about what's really explaining the surge that we're seeing again in about 40 states. CNN just posted a piece called "The U.S. is Seeing a Resurgence of COVID Cases. Small Household Gatherings Are Helping Drive It," according to the CDC.
Yeah, this is becoming worrisome. There's something called pandemic fatigue, lockdown fatigue, distancing fatigue, whatever you call it. It's basically people are getting lackadaisical and they're getting lazy. And they're, you know, especially when they see President of the United States and the White House Rose Garden events, and they're seeing that, like, if they're doing that, why can't I visit my mom I haven't seen in 6 months? And it sets a really wrong tone, wrong example. And people just start breaking these little rules. And of course, along the way, there's so many other misinformation, like herd immunities, sweet little lies that, oh, if you infect enough people, the rest of us were we protected. People think that, oh, then it's okay to be, you know, nonchalant about this. And that is what's happening. And in addition to all the hoax misinformation, I think right now this epidemic will be stuck here for quite a while, because we have a very polarized country, and half of America thinks this virus is overblown and it's going to hurt the rest of us.
Doctors told CNN that they're advising people not to have indoor holiday dinners with others who are not in their immediate household. I mean, some doctors are really concerned that the cases are just going to continue to go up as we head into the colder months. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that is a serious concern, because in certain ways, all of our social events in the summers can be done outdoors in parks and other, you know, outdoor venues. But as winter comes, oftentimes the reason viruses traditionally surge in the winter is that people bring their activities indoors. And this indoor activity yields a lot of close quarter aerosol airborne transmission. And we know people don't open the windows oftentimes when it's cold outside, and they don't have the good ventilation or the indoor HEPA filtration or the more advanced UV, systems that in HVAC systems of advanced buildings that can destroy viruses. Altogether, indoors is the main problem, and that's why winter is coming, and that's what's the main worry of this indoor airborne transmission, because we know it's so infectious indoors.
Well, today we're speaking with Dr. Eric Fagelding, an epidemiologist and senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. He'll be with us for about 15 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions about the COVID surge that we are seeing in many states across the country, especially the northern Midwest, Wisconsin, Montana, the Dakotas, unfortunately, those states are being hit hard. In fact, NPR had an interesting piece about how a Montana town that is already grappling with asbestos from a mine. So a lot of people there already have issues with breathing, and COVID is just making this worse. If you want to learn more about this, you can search on NPR, Montana and COVID. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, William Hennig, a Harvard University infectious disease researcher, told CNN that a lot of the places being hit are Midwest states that were spared in the very beginning. And that is of particular concern, because a lot of these smaller regions do not have the ICU beds and the capacity that urban centers have.
Oh, absolutely. These Midwest states, communities, and very rural areas traditionally are not well-equipped in hospital beds to begin with, and not to mention ICUs as well as nurses and doctors and the infrastructure to get people to the hospital in time. And that's incredibly, incredibly work. That's actually why Wisconsin governor actually created a new field hospital, because they were quickly running out of beds. They just announced it this past weekend. But at these rural areas, you know, at the beginning, people thought, well, this is a urban density New York City type of problem, hence New York had it so bad. But now we're seeing the worst pandemic states are the rural states. And in certain ways, they didn't get hit in the first wave, so they thought, a lot of the people thought it was overblown. And therefore, people have to, what I'm learning is over my years of research is that people have to see it to believe it. And if you don't see it, and you don't know anyone around you who had or came down with COVID, as many of us in New England did, then basically when your president tells you it's a hoax, you don't take it seriously. And also, in addition to these Midwest rural areas not being hit previously very hard, they also have lots of meatpacking factories. And these are naturally super spreading events, as we previously knew. And a lot of these factories did not have PPEs for their farm workers and factory workers. So altogether, really bad situation.
Right. And again, healthcare workers are still saying they do not have adequate personal testing, protective equipment, and testing supplies. Dr. Megan Ranney told the Washington Post, "We are very fearful for what we are heading into."
Yeah, I think Megan is very right, and she's a very vocal expert on schools. I think schools is the other key issue. In addition to PPEs lacking, I think if you are going to reopen schools, as many conservative rural states are doing, then you at least need PPEs for these teachers and students. But they are very, very hard to come by, even in urban settings. And so rural communities are very much out of luck in terms of these PPE supplies. And then, of course, testing, you know, testing, PCR testing is inadequate, but we're trying to ramp up these rapid antigen testing to find as many cases as we can to isolate them. But they're just not available right now. You can't even buy them off the open market. So altogether, it's incredibly, incredibly frustrating. And hence we have this surge right now.
What are your thoughts? Let's first talk about children. More children are being diagnosed with COVID, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Their latest report found a 13% increase in child cases reported from September 24th to October 8th. But also, according to reports, when you look at, you know, children in school, the cases are not rising as fast as people first feared.
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of schools are not meeting in person, and a lot of parents have withdrawn their kids from school. So, but we know that young people do spread it. There's many, many case studies, many, many case reports, and in terms of what we're seeing in the data in all these heat maps of over time trends by age groups, oftentimes they start among 20 to 29-year-olds, but then they quickly spread to 10 to 19-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And these teenagers are actually the number three hottest, you know, in terms of rates of transmission of COVID-19. Now, kids under 10 spread less, but again, a lot of these kids under 10 are kept home, and so you don't have the same amount of exposure. The amount of exposure in which people get is also really important in terms of their risk. And so altogether, kids are not immune. We know thousands of kids who have been hospitalized, hundreds of kids who have died, and tens of thousands of kids who have been infected. And the misinformation that kids are immune, somehow immune, is complete misinformation. And that is floating out there.
Right. It comes from the very top. I mean, it comes from Trump.
Oh, yeah. Trump's pandemic advisor, Scott Atlas, who's both promoting herd immunity as well as kids are virtually immune, as he was quoted many times. That is absolutely false.
And so dangerous. And then when you look at colleges and universities, this is incredible. The New York Times looked at the data and found that at 1,400 colleges across the United States, there have been 178,000 cases and at least 70 deaths since COVID began.
Yeah, I think colleges are an incredibly frustrating situation because if you live in dorms, it's a very small close quarters, and a lot of, you know, fraternity parties off campuses are some of the key hotspots for a lot of these epidemics. But at the same time, whenever universities close, all the public health scientists and epidemiologists are saying we should not send them home because all of a sudden all these hotspot cases of young, oftentimes asymptomatic carriers, sending them home across the country would actually just seed more epidemic across the country. But hence you have to keep them together on campus, which again perpetuates the campus gatherings. So it's a very, very tricky situation. And we know young people, they don't get sick as much, but they still do, but they spread it more and faster to other populations. And it's always, almost always, the young people aged 20 to 29 that is the first wave that then predicts the next surge of upcoming cases in the community.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Fagelding, an epidemiologist and senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. Let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. The perspective I would offer is that things are going to get much worse. And the basis of that perspective is what I've heard in the discussions about Obamacare with the hearings in Congress now with the nominee to the Supreme Court. Once people become concerned that pre-existing illnesses will lead to them not being able to get insurance or having to pay much more, they will, unless they're at death's door, stop getting tested for COVID. Because once you get tested, it's in the government records in order that they can do the tracing. So if someone is not very sick, they're going to decide not to get tested, because if they have a mild case that they're not going to die from, it will count against them because it's in their record. Yes, I had COVID. There's a pre-existing illness. And when the protection against the pre-existing illnesses, extra charges, goes away, it's not going to be, have you had a pre-existing illness since the protections went away? It's going to be, have you ever had a pre-existing illness? So I think we'll look, as people become more believing that Obamacare's protections against charges for pre-existing illnesses are going to go away, people are going to stop getting tested.
Mm. What are your thoughts, Eric?
Yeah, I think that is a potential concern in terms of the anticipation of the pre-existing protection going away. Theoretically, they could put another executive order or pass a bill that protects pre-existing conditions, but obviously that's a pie in the sky. In addition, I want to point out this fear of testing is actually another concern among hourly workers, because hourly workers who are paid, you know, via generic 1099s instead of, you know, W-2 payrolls, oftentimes don't have paid sick leave. And if they test positive, they're forced to isolate, or if one of their colleagues, a coworker, tests positive, they're forced to quarantine, which means loss of all of their hourly, day-to-day ad hoc earnings. And that actually creates a fear bubble that if any one of you or your coworkers goes to get tested and test positive, then all of you are out of a job for 14 days. And that is also driving a lot of anxiety. And this is why we need guaranteed sick leave or universal basic income or guaranteed health care for these people. This is what all this is building into, this secrecy bubble of fear of being tested positive. And I think this anxiety around the Affordable Care Act right now is absolutely not helping. Mm.
Well, William, thank you for bringing up this really important point, because Obamacare is going to be heard by the Supreme Court on November 10th, exactly 1 week after the presidential election. And the concern you raise really deserves more attention. So thank you for bringing that up today. Let's go next to Andrea in Sebastopol. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I live in a community that's extremely anti-vax. Just this morning, I got a text from someone telling me not to vaccinate my child for flu, and gave me a link to Facebook, and I was beside myself. So now I'm asking you, how do we know? This is like a twofold question, I guess. How do we know that the vaccine for COVID will be safe? And then how do we educate those who don't even believe in the known vaccines that we've been using for years and years, like even the flu shot?
And that's a very good question. And vaccines, just so you know, sometimes you hear that there's a vaccine trial being halted. That's actually a good thing. Like, if we found an adverse event but didn't halt enrollment and, you know, just try to deal with it later and sweep it under the rug, that would actually be the less cautious thing. If anything, you know, a lot of these vaccines, we do these trials rigorously with 30,000, 60,000 enrollment. The one of the trials is enrolling 30, Moderna, I think, but the Johnson & Johnson is enrolling 60,000 people. You need that many people to make sure that it works. It works in different populations, and it's safe, and it's safe in different populations, so that you can actually tease out the signal as opposed to anecdotal evidence. And a lot of the anti-vaxxer misinformation out there is just based on anecdotal evidence. And there's just not support for that. These trials are critical. And the other key thing is, if you try to rush them and before you have all the data that you need, because vaccine trials, these phase threes, are basically following 60,000 people to see them naturally get infected on, you know, just by community transmission. If you try to rush it, then you don't have enough data. And that actually creates the vaccine hesitancy that's going to shoot ourselves in the foot. And so I guarantee you vaccines are safe. And we filter them through several layers of animal testing, lab testing, and then phase one, phase two, and now 60,000 persons phase three testing. But the key thing is you have to wait for the data.
You know, Eric, it's so hard for public health officials, given what you are up against with Trump and the CDC. I mean, basically what's happening here is other countries have put public health officials in charge. And what the Trump administration has done is put political appointees with no public health experience in charge, which is making your job so much harder. And it's directly connected to the vaccine, because Dr. Ashish Jha said, you know, Johnson & Johnson pausing the clinical trial because of an unexplained illness in one of the volunteers is completely expected. That is what happens with these trials. Mm-hmm. And he said it's a reminder of how ridiculous it is to try and meet Trump's political timeline of having a vaccine in the coming weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think there's been many people worked in government who didn't have an epidemiology or public health degree, but still respected science. But right now, under Trump administration, we've heard so many countless anecdotes and stories and reports of CDC being muzzled, CDC being overruled, whether it's the cruise ships or whether it's the public transit mask mandates that the Trump administration overruled, or tons of other CDC censorship. That just, of course, makes things so, so frustrating. And, you know, the vaccine trials, you can't rush, because it's not like you can just infect people faster. That would be actually called a challenge trial, in which you give someone a vaccine, then purposely give them a virus. Those are very risky, and they only do them in animals. But you can't, you know, you can't rush this kind of stuff. And actually, these vaccine stoppages, trial stoppages, happen all the time with tons of other drugs, too. You just never hear about them because the public doesn't have interest in a lot of these drug trial nuance. You only hear about them because we're in the middle of COVID pandemic for the COVID vaccine. So this is a bit of a reporting bias, but this is the system working normally as it's supposed to, as Dr. Jha has said. And, you know, I've worked on many trials before. These DSMB data safety monitoring board reviews are incredibly, incredibly detailed. They will not let a shoddy vaccine out. And there are dozens and dozens of vaccines being tested. This is why it's good to join the global consortium, the WHO COVAX consortium, as opposed to do it yourself and put all of your eggs in a few baskets, as the Trump has done with Warp Speed and refusing to join any global collaboration.
So, Eric, what advice would you give people as we head into the colder months?
I think the key thing in terms of transmission is aerosol, airborne transmission. Please, please be careful. You just have to assume anytime you breathe, not just talk or sing, but anytime you breathe, you actually can breathe in and breathe out the coronavirus from someone else to someone else. And just because you don't see someone, for example, in a public bathroom, which oftentimes are poorly ventilated, just because there's no one else in the bathroom does not mean the coronavirus is not there. We know that there's toilet plumes, aerosols, or in any room, not just bathroom, that I think people need to wear masks. And if there's a lot of people not wearing masks, I think they have to wear premium masks. And the premium masks being the surgical / KN95, there's a Korean KF94. All these other premium masks, I think, will be really critical. And think of filtration, HEPA filtration, MERV 13 level air filters. These are all really key as we spend more and more time indoors in the coming months in the winter time.
The problem is, though, that it's hard to get your hands on the N95 masks.
Yeah, well, the KN95, you can actually buy at Staples. And the KF94. Yeah, so KN95 is not these round ones that are, you know, the healthcare workers use. KN95, King Nancy 95, is a substitute that the FDA approves, although there are a lot of knockoffs. And the KF94s, you can get them from Amazon. They're the masks used in Korea the most. It's the Koreans' KN95. And so you can find them, and you're not depleting healthcare workers' N95 masks.
Okay.
So I think these are really, really good precautions to go beyond cloth masks, because cloth masks only work if everyone wears them. But if half the people don't wear them and breathing them out, then you need to self-protect yourselves.
Exactly. And there's an incredible piece by Sheila Kaplan of the New York Times on October 9th. She reports that the CDC drafted a sweeping order last month requiring all passengers and employees to wear masks on all forms mm-hmm. of public and commercial transportation in the U.S., but it was blocked by the White House.
Yeah, exactly. It was blocked by the Trump White House. The CDC wanted it, and the White House overruled it. Mm-hmm. And also, there were petitions to the, you know, Senate on Transportation Committee, but all of these petitions by unions, by, you know, transit workers were all overruled and basically not accepted in part of any legislation for the coronavirus relief bill either. So it's so incredibly frustrating. Masks work. Cloth masks work if everyone wears them. But if not everyone wears them, and a lot of people are very, you know, blasé, and I think we have to really think about more premium masks and buying HEPA filters for indoor environments, and just assume that any room you're in has potentially coronavirus from someone who was there a few minutes before.
And we don't have time to take George's question, but just quickly, Eric, where do you go for the most up-to-date information on COVID?
Well, I try to tweet as much as I can, but obviously CDC website is as good as what the CDC is allowed to put out. For example, the aerosol transmission. I think WHO is getting much better. And in terms of statistics, Johns Hopkins, coronavirus.jhu.edu is really good on statistics on and positivity in every state. And coronavirus now is also a really good resource. So I think there's a lot of these resources that gives you stats and on the different states. But in terms of actually the latest information, you know, I wish we had a great effective CDC that isn't muzzled. But I think a combination of news sources and academia sources are probably the best, and verified Twitter accounts that are reputable.
And Eric tweets a lot, and his tweets are fantastic. So, Eric, thank you for joining us, and thank you for all of your work.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
You too. Thank you. Dr. Eric Fagelding is an epidemiologist and senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. He was one of the first people to alert the public on the risks of COVID. So he is really on top of everything, and we will definitely continue to bring him back in the coming months. After a short break, we are going to talk about why it is taking so long for COVID relief. The Democrats are fighting for $600 a week in unemployment benefits. The Republicans say $400. And so now you've got progressive Democrats saying, well, we've got to make a deal because people need relief. What are your thoughts? We'll talk about that right after a break. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we're going to talk about COVID relief. The additional $600 in weekly unemployment benefits expired in mid-July. Since then, we have heard so many stories from people who are struggling to make ends meet. One in four households has lost jobs or income since the start of the pandemic. According to the U.S. Census, at least 10% of adults say they sometimes or often do not have enough to eat. Lines at food banks are still very long, months into the pandemic. 30 to 40% of renters are at risk of eviction. Here is a clip of CNN reporting from an eviction court in Columbus, Ohio.
118 evictions are on the docket today. Among them, Umu Conte.
I work in the nursing home. When I get infected with the COVID.
Conte says she contracted the virus in June at the nursing home where she worked. The U.S. resident, an immigrant from Sierra Leone, was out of work for 2 months. She's now working as a home health care aide, making $12 an hour. It's not enough to pay the rent she owes.
They give me 30 days. I'm just thinking about my kids. Where did I go with my kids?
Thanks to Now This for that clip. They point out that renters of color are twice as likely to be evicted as white renters. Senate Republicans say they will take up their COVID relief bill next week, but Speaker Nancy Pelosi says their bill does not go far enough. Democrats like Representative Ro Khanna say the Republican bill is better than nothing at this point, and they are pressuring Pelosi to make a deal. Joining us to talk about this is Jeff Shirky, a lecturer at the University of Illinois. He's been a contributor to Working in These Times since 2013, and his latest piece is called The Nightmare Facing the Poor and Working Class If There's Not Another Stimulus. Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, here we are. The Democrats passed a bill in October. They want to provide people with another $1,200 check along with $600 in weekly unemployment benefits, along with money for PPE, for schools, for states. The Republican bill is much, much smaller. They want $400 a week. And now you've got moderates and progressives saying, Nancy Pelosi, people are struggling. Just accept the bill. What are your thoughts on where we are right now?
Yeah, well, thanks. I think I can understand the frustration of the congressional Democrats and Nancy Pelosi, right? They've passed the HEROES Act back in May, which was meant to be a follow-up and continuation to the CARES Act. So just to be clear, there's only – since this pandemic started, really hit the United States in March, there's only been one economic stimulus package, which was the CARES Act in late March. That was over 6 months ago, and there's been nothing from the federal government since. And so much of the economic aid that was provided by the CARES Act has already expired or dried up. And the congressional Democrats did pass, you know, the HEROES Act to extend this aid all the way back in May, and there hasn't been really much urgency coming from the Trump administration or from Senate Republicans until, you know, just in the past week or so. And even still from the Senate Republicans and Mitch McConnell, there's really been nothing. It's only, you know, you mentioned the Republican bill of that would offer $400 per week in unemployment or an unemployment supplement instead of the $600. And that's not coming from Senate Republicans. That's coming from the Trump administration itself and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. So the Senate Republicans don't seem to really be interested in anything except maybe extending the loans for small businesses under the Paycheck Protection Program. But to get to your question, I think I certainly sympathize with Representative Ro Khanna and everyone else who's saying that, you know, something is better than nothing. That's absolutely true. And some kind of deal has to be made like now, today, tomorrow, this week. I mean, something needed to be done months ago. But I can understand Nancy Pelosi and the congressional Democrats feeling frustrated that they've been ready at the negotiating table. They put forward a proposal. They passed the HEROES Act back in May. Then they scaled it down to try to meet the Republicans halfway with a revised HEROES Act that they passed on October 1st. And it's only in the last week or so that we've seen any urgency coming from the Trump administration with their own bill. I can understand Speaker Pelosi saying, well, wait a minute, we've been here. Let's hold out maybe for another day or two to try to get a better deal for workers, a little bit more money in their pockets. But like I said, I think, something is better than nothing, and a deal does have to be made.
Right. And it's a difficult position to be in because, I mean, obviously the Republicans are spending their time trying to get Amy Coney Barrett confirmed.
Right.
I mean, that's their main goal here.
Right.
As people can't afford food, small businesses are shutting down. I mean, we just heard that clip from that woman who might lose her home. I mean, Jeff, we know how the Republicans operate. And I think that's why Ro Khanna has stepped up and said, you know, my constituents need help. Let's just take what we can get rather than get nothing, because this is how Republicans work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really kind of shameful that it's the both Trump and the Senate Republicans, their main priority, like you said, is confirming Amy Coney Barrett. Like I said, it's been over 6 months since there's been any economic relief, and yet they're going to appoint this, you know, right-wing judge to the Supreme Court faster than any judge we've seen in recent memory. So, yeah, I think assistance was needed months ago, mm-hmm. and I do agree. Something is better than nothing. There's also, it's worth noting, some of the things in the Republican bill could be harmful to workers as well. One of the things they're trying to get is liability protections for employers. Many workers, you know, frontline workers have been working in unsafe conditions during the pandemic without proper PPE and other kinds of protections. And employers and Republicans are trying to make sure that workers can't sue them and hold them responsible. So they're trying to sneak into this bill liability protection. So there's a lot to go through, you know, to make sure that gets that they get to. But I really feel the onus here of who's responsible and who needs to step up is the president and the Senate Republicans, because again, the Democrats have been at the table for months and months. If there's no progress, you know, by tomorrow, I think Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin are supposed to have a conversation tomorrow. If there's no progress, then yes, Speaker Pelosi should take the deal that's on the table right now. But it is really shameful that it's taken all of this time, and only now, when there's just a few weeks until the election, that the Trump administration is finally willing to negotiate. You know, where were they this whole time?
Right. Well, to the point you made about what's in the Republican bill, Steve just wrote, Pelosi and Schumer are right to oppose the GOP's new offer, not because of the amount, but rather the changed language in the bill. It is a bailout for big business. Resist. So what are your thoughts about where the Democrats are and what Ro Khanna and others are calling for, that Pelosi should strike a deal because people are really desperate to make ends meet? But then you have to look at the language that's in the Republican bill. And we've got just about under 10 minutes if you'd like to weigh in on this. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Greg writes in, what is Pelosi's strategy? Does she think she can make the Republicans blink? What are the odds? He has a few other words in there about the Republicans, but what are the odds?
That's a great question. And, you know, one thing that could be instructive is last Tuesday, President Trump tweeted that he was ending negotiations until after the election, or after he wins the election, is what he said. And then he got, you know, immediate blowback from that, from all sides. And very quickly he backtracked and said, okay, I'm going to keep negotiating. So it seems clear that Trump understands that for this election, he needs to, you know, it's really incumbent on him politically to to get a deal done. So there is a lot of pressure on him. So, you know, it could be possible. I have no idea what Nancy Pelosi's strategy is, really, to be honest, but it could be possible. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that the Trump administration could blink and could, you know, offer something more in terms of just more money in the pockets of the American people. I know the Democrats got a lot of criticism, justly so, for I guess it's a question, how just was it? A lot of criticism for voting for the CARES Act, because while it did extend economic relief to unemployed people and you know, Americans in general, it also offered a lot of, you know, $500 billion in corporate bailouts, which the Federal Reserve leveraged into trillions of dollars in corporate bailouts. So that, you know, I think the Democrats don't want to do that again. They want to just stick to the economic relief aspect.
Exactly. And we're going to do a show about this after the election. But The Intercept reports that the banks stand to make $18 billion in PPP processing fees from the CARES Act. That's just one aspect of it. But we'll do that after the election. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Duane in San Francisco. Hi, Duane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is really a tough topic, and my concern is about strategy around this and in general, but just to know that Ro Khanna comes out publicly and says, oh, we should just take the deal, that's the problem. Like, you keep saying that's what the Republicans do, they should just accept. But the problem is the Democrats don't change their strategy. They don't know how to speak with a unified voice. If he disagrees, they should be doing this completely out of the public eye and maintaining a unified front. If there's one thing the Republicans do, is they present a unified front, and they just stand with their arms crossed and say, now you deal with it. Well, why don't the Democrats do the same thing? And I realize that for this issue, it's a hard one to talk about, but this is a growing frustration of mine around all issues.
Yeah, I hear you, especially around the messaging. I mean, we have no idea, obviously, what went on behind the scenes, but Ro Khanna on October 11th tweeted, people in need cannot wait until February. You know, he says, make a deal and put the ball in the McConnell court, is basically what he tweeted. So Duane has a good point here, but again, we just have no idea what went on behind the scenes, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with all of this, both the CARES Act and all of this, is that it's not very transparent. There's not really open debate. It's just a few, you know, it's Pelosi and Mnuchin having phone calls with each other. Occasionally, maybe Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell are involved in these conversations. The rest of, you know, other elected members of Congress, like Ro Khanna, probably don't know much more about what's going on than the rest of us do, I would imagine. And that's, you know, for something we're talking, these bills that they're being discussed are in the trillions of dollars. And this is the kind of thing that should be much more open and transparent. Again, because that's part of why the CARES Act, which was supposed to be simply about economic relief and COVID relief in March, wound up being a massive bailout for big corporations and banks.
Can we briefly talk about the long-term effects of this economic crisis? Obviously, evictions are absolutely horrific. It is so hard to get back on your feet after you've been evicted. There's so much trauma involved in this. A lot of people are having a hard time finding decent paying jobs. I mean, and then the bigger picture is, you know, small businesses. I want to make sure we also talk about that, because we've heard from so many small business owners who are having a tough time. And then you've got public schools, parks, civil servants. I mean, there's just such a massive trickle effect here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just the unemployment, like you said, I think something like 60 million Americans have been unemployed at some point during this crisis. Right now, there's over 25 million on unemployment. And there's, according to the Economic Policy Institute, there are 14 million more jobless workers than job openings in the United States. So no matter what people do, there's going to be unemployment. And I've been unemployed before. You know, if anyone's been unemployed as an adult for more than a couple of months, you can know that both economically and financially what a strain it is, but also just mentally and emotionally, sending out your job applications and waiting to hear back and hoping you hear something good, and the stress of that, the anxiety of that. And, you know, one thing leads to another. People, when they have money in their pockets, when they have an income, when they have this extra $600 in unemployment or the $1,200 check or whatever it is, they can spend that money, and that money supports other jobs. You know, that $600 supplement to unemployment was supporting 5 million jobs, the money that was being spent from that. So it all kind of cycles around. And yes, with the small businesses, many of the small businesses that have taken the Paycheck Protection Program loans, they're already, you know, running out of money. The National Restaurant Association did a survey and found that up to 40% of all restaurants in the country could be going out of business within the next several months, which would just mean massive, massive unemployment. And the more unemployment there is, the less money can be spent, you know, if it's a consumer-driven economy. So when people aren't spending money, that just hurts businesses more and means more layoffs, and it ends up being this vicious cycle.
Well, yeah, exactly. That 40% number is just devastating. And right now, a lot of restaurants are trying to make it by having outdoor dining. But once the winter months, you know, are here, that's going to be very difficult. Mm-hmm. So we are going to continue following the latest on COVID relief. And we will bring you the latest. I just checked on Twitter, and a number of reporters are saying that Pelosi and Mnuchin are actually talking right now. So we will bring you the latest in the coming days. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for the article you wrote for In These Times, Jeff.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Jeff Shirky is a lecturer at the University of Illinois, and you can find his piece, The Nightmare Facing the Poor and Working Class If There's Not Another Stimulus. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And you can find today's show, if you'd like to share it with friends or colleagues, you could find our past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. We'll be right back.